Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what an organizer of Arizona's protests over SB 1070 makes of the immigration-related protests going on now in L.A., and why the Tucson City Council may have to adjust its free fare program for the city bus system. But first, universities across the country are dealing with changes coming from the federal government, and concerns in the academic world are not limited to the Ivy League. In addition to these newer issues, the University of Arizona is still recovering from last year's financial crisis. The school has a new president and other new members of the administration, and my next guest says despite the challenges, the mood at the university among faculty is resilient. Layla Hudson is a professor of global studies at the University of Arizona and chair of the faculty. She says the faculty is just getting to know President Garamella and his team, but that they continue to be optimistic. Hudson says Garamella has been good about reforming the ranks of upper management, but she thinks there's still too big of a divide between management and faculty. I spoke with Hudson earlier, and we started with how much she attributes issues between the faculty and administration to factors that are maybe unique to the U of A, and how much she attributes to the administration's response to external factors, like directives coming from D.C.
We're in the same boat as just about every other university or college in the country in terms of the national landscape. We come into this moment, however, with some unique background, an administration under the Robbins administration that left us with a $250 million financial crisis, was certainly not the way that one would want to go into what we now see as the federal funding crisis and the extension of what many people think are unlawful encroachments on constitutional rights, academic freedom, and institutional integrity. So we come into this national challenging moment with a previous crisis that we're still trying to rectify. The bright side of that, however, is that we are more resilient, more experienced, more knowledgeable about institutional mechanics than other universities that might not have had the same catastrophic maladministration in previous years.
Let me ask you about a referendum that the faculty recently voted on, asking the president and asking the Board of Regents for a few things, including not to comply with what are deemed unlawful demands from the Trump administration, sign a call for constructive engagement. It's a statement signed by a number of other university presidents in response to executive orders, a mutual academic defense compact with other public land-grant universities. Have you gotten any kind of response to any of those? Do you have any indication whether or not President Garamella is inclined to do any of these things?
Well, our most encouraging response is that our new provost, Patricia Prelock, was serving as the interim president of the University of Vermont and had signed the letter that we asked our current president to sign in her capacity as the interim president of the University of Vermont. So we know that the values that we are defending and pushing our administration to articulate here in the state of Arizona are ones that we have good reason to think that they share with the faculty and staff of the University of Arizona. So while we continue to wait for the kind of action that the faculty who voted overwhelmingly called for, we haven't been idle. We ourselves have met together with the faculty governance leadership of other public land grant universities to try and do the legwork, to do the background work that will make us part of a resilient network of institutions that can band together.
It kind of sounds like you're trying to create almost like a NATO for universities, where like an attack on one is an attack on all.
Exactly. Yes, and it was a very creative idea. I hope we won't have to test it. But yes, that is the idea that an attack on one is an attack on all.
So you mentioned that, you have the sense and the feeling that, the administration, the leadership of the university is, sort of on the same page with what you would like to see happen. I'm curious, though, from your perspective, like, what is the role of a university president? Maybe what specifically is the role of the University of Arizona president in terms of trying to stick up for the university and push back on administration orders and rules that it deems not okay?
Yeah. Well, I think many university presidents see their role, ironically, as a non-academic role. They see themselves as diplomats, if you will, handling external relations with the outside world, with donors, with sports conferences and fans. And importantly, with local structures of government. That is why the job of the provost, and I mentioned our new provost, Patricia Prelog, for whom I have great expectations. The provost is the chief academic officer, if you will, who oversees what at the University of Arizona or any other world-class institution is a sprawling, decentralized, multi-billion dollar enterprise. So those two roles together should provide us with the leadership and the guidance that we need.
Is there any concern on your part, or maybe any of your colleagues' part, of getting, for lack of a better word, getting the Harvard treatment? Like, if you push back too much, that, the U of A becomes sort of the next university to have all sorts of things happen to it from the Trump administration?
Well, I think in fact that is a real concern, not so much from Washington, but from the state legislature in Phoenix. There's been a very explicit dialogue going back and forth between legislative leaders and the presidents of our three public universities, making very explicit demands. So I think those who are most directly charged with stewarding the universities are worried about crossing those who hold, for the moment, the purse strings. Those of us who are less motivated by that kind of immediate political conjuncture are more concerned about the long-term risks of buckling under to governmental interference and governmental pressure. After all, that flies in the face of the freedoms, not only that we hold dear, but which are absolutely central to performing our mission.
At the end of the day, would you say that you have confidence in the leadership at the University of Arizona to address the kinds of issues that universities across the country and in Tucson are dealing with right now?
I have confidence that the people of the University of Arizona will make our voices heard and that our leadership, as it gains confidence, will reflect those very foundational shared values. I'm not sure I would say I yet have confidence in our leadership, but I do have confidence in my colleagues, our students, and our community.
All right. That is Dr. Layla Hudson, a professor of global studies at the University of Arizona, chair of the faculty at the U of A as well. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We also reached out to U of A President Suresh Garamella's office for comment on this. We'll post the entire statement from university spokesperson Mitch Zack at theshow.kjzz.org. But it says, in part, the president and university leadership are actively involved in higher education advocacy, including publishing op-eds on the value of research, maintaining regular contact with Arizona state and federal delegation, and engaging key stakeholders to protect the university's interests and uphold its mission. The Trump administration says it's sending 700 Marines and 2,000 more National Guard troops to Los Angeles. Protests against ICE arrests have been ongoing for a few days now there. Some of the images of the current protests in L.A. are evocative of those from Phoenix more than a decade ago, when protesters took to the streets to voice their opposition to the immigration law known as SB 1070. Luis Avila helped organize those protests. He's a community organizer and president of Iconico Campaigns, which helps organizations build up their abilities to advocate. He joins me. Luis, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for being here. So I'm curious, like, when you watch or hear about what's going on in LA, like, what comes to mind for you, especially given your experience here in Phoenix?
Well, you know, it's a mix of sadness, you know, anger and pride, to be honest, just to know that our government is mobilizing these needed resources in other places to oppress and go after people, including, you know, everyone from children to journalists. It's a very sad day. It's a very hard thing to see. At the same time, I'm really proud of the fact that people are standing up for their rights and that they are calling these injustices and ensuring that people know that this is something that won't happen in LA. I think that the sentiment was shared here in Arizona in 2010 when people mobilized in big numbers against SB 1070, the Show Me Your Papers laws. But also something that happened, you know, before that in 2006, 2007, against the oppression of people like Joe Arpaio as well. So this is something familiar to us in Arizona, and it's something that we are aware could happen anywhere as well.
I wonder about some of the both similarities and differences between 2010 in Phoenix and now in L.A. And I wonder, sort of like from an organizing standpoint, like with SB 1070, like you kind of saw that one coming, right? Like the bill was moving through the legislature. You kind of had a sense of what was going to happen. Whereas in L.A. right now, I mean, it seems as though it was maybe a bit more spontaneous. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, 2010 and SB 1070 was a result of years of anti-immigrant legislation, draconian leadership from people like Russell Pierce at the Senate, you know, movements like the Minutemen in the southern part of Arizona. So in some ways, 2010 was, you know, a culmination of that anti-immigrant sentiment and policies. So we had a lot of time to build coalitions and institutions and connect with each other, sometimes across difference, you know, with people who were working on the impacts and economic impacts or the social impacts, the human impacts of anti-immigrant legislation. So in some ways, in 2010, we had the infrastructure to respond. We had the messages, the connections, but also we were, you know, mobilizing and defending ourselves in some ways against the laws and the people from the state of Arizona. In this case, the people from LA are seeing something unprecedented, and that is federal forces used against citizens, which is not just something scary, but extremely dangerous for us to consider that if there is dissent in the United States, now, you know, the military could be mobilized against us.
Do you see a straight line between the SB 1070 protests and what we're seeing now in LA?
I see a straight line between Arizona and what's happening in the anti-immigrant movement nationally. In some ways, Arizona is a microcosm and hopefully a lesson to the rest of the country. When Arizona was what we were called the epicenter of hate, right? Like around the country, so people saw us as a backward state that we're going against people who were, you know, some of the most vulnerable populations in our state. Our economy was impacted by the billions. You know, our reputation in the state got really tarnished for years. As we remember, people refused to come in conferences and concerts, and really the view of the state of Arizona was was really impacted. And I think in some ways, you know, the microcosm of what Arizona is to the rest of the country is exactly that. The United States is now seen internationally as a place that maybe you don't want to go study in one of the best universities in the world, because you might, you know, be hung in the middle of the semester or be picked up by a masked person. Really, the United States is shooting its foot in itself in the foot. By actually creating this image of anti-immigrant sentiment and, you know, that they're against the people who want to make a better life in this place.
Why do you think it is that we haven't seen the kinds of protests in Phoenix or other parts of Arizona that we have seen in L.A. recently? I mean, there are certainly some protesters at the state capitol. There are folks by the, you know, the federal courthouse protesting ICE activities there. But we're certainly not seeing anything like the images coming out of L.A.
Yeah, I think that, you know, social movements and protests are shown and reacted in different ways. There is a vast infrastructure in the state of Arizona of immigrant advocates and immigrant defenders. And as we speak today, they are, you know, all across the city doing accompaniment and witnessing and recording and observing bad behavior from ICE agents, from some of these folks who we don't even know if they're ICE agents. They're just showing up with masked faces, like some of them are not identifying themselves. And Arizona right now, it's in a very strong effort to protect our communities, to ensure that they know their rights, that we're sharing information with people. As we know, these efforts are not only impacting undocumented people, but also residents and citizens. So the effort in Arizona has been very much on the ground. Tons of organizations and people are out there today talking to people and ensuring that they are documenting what's happening. I think what happened in LA, though, it was a very different story. It's one of those things like happened in the perfect storm, right? The conditions were right for people to come out on the streets and actually fight back. It started in Paramount with a really big raid in Paramount in one of the areas of Los Angeles, but it spread out to the whole city as we have seen it thanks to social media. We have to remember, too, that back in 2010, 2006, when we were mobilizing people, social media wasn't as strong as we have it now.
Right.
So we see other ways of communicating as well.
As an organizer, how do you try to keep things from devolving into violence? Like, I would imagine when you see pictures of cars on fire, that's probably not what you want to see, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in my personal opinion, violence is not something that I condone. It's not something that I support. The efforts in Arizona and many of the protesters in Los Angeles as well, as we have seen, are peaceful protests. I mean, the people who are reporting from the ground are showing that people are showing up peacefully and that they're being agitated and they are being also in some ways harassed by police forces. And I think that the president mobilizing the military is just, you know, throwing gas to the fire. He is not acting in good faith. And I think that his efforts are actually causing more harm than a real solution to the conversation that we're having, which is separating families and picking up people just because of the way they look or they sound. It's not an American value. It's not something that we should be supporting.
All right, I'll have to leave it there. That is Luis Avila, president of Iconico Campaigns, a community organizer. Luis, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, young men are being radicalized online, but one author says this isn't anything new, especially for young autistic men.
Because there's difficulty connecting people, there's difficulty with social isolation. I think that primes someone for being radicalized online.
We'll hear how the internet is exposing more young men to extreme values. But first, as we mentioned yesterday, this week, we're bringing you a series of conversations about modern masculinity and the various ways it's being expressed and debated. We continue that series now with Nick Owen, a recent U of A graduate whose thesis project was a film that combined images of the Sonoran Desert with original poetry about his evolving relationship with his gender identity and sexuality. Owen spoke with my co-host, Sam Dingman.
So tell me a little bit about the voice of the poetry in the film, because I was really interested in the way that a lot of times you're sort of addressing the desert directly, using the desert as a way of talking about certain ways of perceiving masculinity. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of have three, I guess, characters in this work. And there's the narrator, obviously, which we'll I'll come back to in a sec. But then there's the sort of like deified version of the desert that is usually the one being spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the third kind of masculine presence that is being spoken about a lot of the time. He's kind of that he in the background. And the main goal of the narrator, the speaker in this, in the poems, is to kind of find his place, his existence between both worlds, but also in a way deconstructs the line between the masculine ideology versus the natural desert world.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting about what you're doing with the he character is that sometimes it feels like the presence of that character is welcome, something that the narrator desires and is like trying to invite. And then sometimes it feels like that presence is unwelcome or sort of like there's tension about that presence.
Right.
And there's a movement back and forth there.
Yeah, I think that was a very personal aspect as well. I think like I'm somebody who kind of came into my queer identity a little bit later in life, quote unquote. Like end of high school is when I was finally coming into that part of myself. And at that point, I was like in very male dominated spaces. And so I think there's a part of me that still thinks that's who I am, that's who I want to be. But I also want to maybe sever myself from that masculinity. And it's just that internal battle that becomes external in the poetry.
Yeah, yeah. I love the line. There's a line in there somewhere about the desert as a canvas primed for glaze.
Your body is flat now, kiln fired smooth. Your emptiness, an invitation for innovation, a canvas primed for glaze.
Tell me about that line. That feels connected to what you were just talking about.
I mean, looking at the Sonoran Desert in particular, I mean, a lot of people kind of overlook its beauty. It's one of, I believe, one of, if not the greenest deserts in the world. But still, you'll have people kind of write it off as just this flat, empty, barren wasteland. But really, it's so full and so lively, especially when it rains, especially at night, those times when nobody really wants to go see it. In a similar way, you have that like queer masculinity that exists often in the shadows, you know, in moments where you feel safe from the gaze of other people.
So mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about the visual manifestation of the piece is the way it opens, which is that we're in a car. And there's somebody driving. And we don't really get a lot of detail about who that person is. It seems to be a male-presenting person. And then as the rest of the film unfolds, we see a lot of images of the desert, as you were just alluding to. We see the unexpectedly vibrant flowers that grow there, horses, we see mountain ranges, we see fruit, we see the human body. But we keep returning to the car, and even when we don't see the car, we can hear it. We can hear the sound of the car driving along the road. What was interesting and important to you about that imagery and sound?
It actually all kind of comes back to the title and the like Bible verse that's opens the story. So it's Isaiah 40 lines 3-5. And of course it's from whatever translation sounded the best.
Right.
And the line that I pull from is, "In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God." And of course I took "make straight in the desert" because straight is obviously the expectation, but
yep.
I originally was going to name the piece "Make Straight in the Desert a Highway," just because I felt like the highway was such an important line. And like, I also feel like a lot of the American Southwest can understand that feeling of being on the highway and just looking out and seeing kind of nothingness and flatness and power lines and maybe a mountain range way in the distance. And the highway is kind of that expectation almost. Like build the highway for our God. Like the highway is going to be the thing that leads us to our proper presentation, our proper respect and fear of God. And or in this case, the highway is going to lead us to that true masculinity. And in the end, there's not really, there ends up not being a destination for the car. Like it's just driving.
There is also a lot of violence in the poems. There's one line in particular: "In my brain, there are hills like yours, impaled with silver skeletons." There's also a whole sequence where on screen we're being showed a piece of citrus, and we see hands ripping the skin of the citrus open and the juice flowing out. And as that's happening, we hear lines about the speaker having a similar sensation with their own body.
"His teeth work their way through me, purposefully, like a machine. I feel his tongue tighten at my tang. Tender, carnal, blood-red tendrils. The chewing, grinding, grinds to a halt. He curls over, heaves."
What was interesting to you about that? Because a lot of the piece focuses on, you know, the kind of quiet beauty of the desert, but you also, in these sequences, are not shying away from the harsher elements of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the desert is a violent place, and I didn't want to downplay that. Like, the desert, whether it be in nature where you have spiny plants and lots of scavenging animals and vultures and coyotes, and of course the heat is lethal. Like, everything about the Sonoran Desert is pretty intense. And so I think it would be kind of unfair to portray the desert as just this beautiful thing. At the same time, though, I feel like that violence can be beautiful. And I wanted to write the poetry in a way that made the speaker, who is undergoing this sort of especially bodily violence towards the end, I wanted to portray it as not so much of a negative feeling, more of a cathartic sort of sense, where like we're being broken apart, but maybe it's for the best in some type of way.
Well, Nick Owen is the writer and the filmmaker of Make Straight in the Desert, the poetry film that he did as part of his thesis work at the University of Arizona. Nick, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. And for the next installment in our exploration of modern masculinity, let's turn to something we've been hearing about for years now, the so-called loneliness epidemic. Young men in particular seem to be more isolated than ever, spending vast amount of time on the internet where they're susceptible to radical points of view on, among other things, male identity. As we've talked about on the show before, that's resulting in a clear rightward drift in young men's politics and creating renewed concern about how to counteract the extreme ideologies they're being exposed to. Eric Garcia is a reporter and author, and lately he's been writing about the ways that men with autism express their gender identities. Garcia himself grew up autistic, and as he recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, he sees a lot of overlap between the struggles autistic men have been dealing with for decades and many of the current issues confronting young men in general.
We're only now seeing, with largely neurotypical young men, what I'd been seeing for a long time with autistic young men online.
Right, which, you know, goes back
I
to...
I was an autistic young man online.
Talk a little bit about that. What was that like for you?
Yeah, like, you know, I'm 34. And, you know, I think I found a lot of solace as a very isolated teenager in the suburbs of California on music forums and on dating myself, MySpace.
That's okay. I remember MySpace.
It was a place where I could puff myself up and I could argue and I could have the force of my ideas and I could be bigger than I was in reality. And at the same time, like, I fully admit that I said a lot of racist and homophobic things around that time when I was younger, because it felt kind of liberating. Like, hey, I'm using an anonymous account, like with a screen name, you know, like, and I could say whatever I want. There's no accountability for that.
Well, Eric, you're making me think about some other conversations I've had about this. And I'm curious to know if this is how you felt, that sometimes that type of behavior that you're describing amongst young men in particular, you know, it's less that they're saying these racist or homophobic things because they believe them, and more because they know that they're going to get a reaction and that it feels good to take up space in public life, even if it's virtual.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, because it's like there's this feeling that you're powerless in real life, or IRL, as they say on the internet.
Yeah.
And I was really nerdy. I was a big bookworm growing up. I was overweight. I just was very awkward. Like I said, I was autistic growing up, and I didn't know how to relate to my peers.
Mm-hmm.
And on the internet, there was this feeling that, like, if you could say the most shocking thing, you could get a rise out of people.
To me, what you're getting at there is nuance in a conversation about masculinity, which is something that is vanishingly rare in public discourse. I mean, we have a difficult enough time talking about masculinity amongst neurotypical men, and I would imagine that it's even harder to find conversations at all, let alone nuanced ones, in the autistic community.
It's weird, because in one way, I'm really glad that nowadays we don't focus solely on autistic boys anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, really glad that we focus on girls, trans people, and non-binary people. But like, I feel like I don't want to do it at the expense of ignoring the questions of masculinity, because for better or for worse, we're still going to have to deal with men. We're still going to live with men.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so like raising and steering good men is really important to me. Yeah. And then I think about like, and then what I thought about is like, what were the things that kept me from being disconnected growing up? I'm an Eagle Scout,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I had a lot of very positive men that way. I had my stepdad. I had my guitar teacher, who's still one of my best friends.
Yeah.
Strong men who are secure in their masculinity, but who don't use it to bully other people.
That all makes sense, Eric. But I know you mentioned MySpace, but, you know, you mentioned you were 34, which means you were growing up in a time that, comparatively speaking, was way less online, where if you were looking for community amongst other men, or even being compelled to find community amongst other men, it was much less likely to be in a virtual, more radicalized, more extreme, more binary sort of space.
Yeah. So like, I spent a lot of time on heavy metal forums when I was younger.
Uh-huh.
And like, heavy metal is extremely masculine. If I think about how I got into those toxic ways of thinking and those toxic behaviors in my time, I think about now how much more aggressively online this generation is, especially when they were locked in for a year and a half, and how, you know, they just kind of went down internet rabbit holes.
Yeah.
We think about now how we've seen graph after graph about how young people are drinking less and are having sex less and are just spending more time on the internet. You know, it's funny because I think about it, and it was like when I was coming up, I was going on these forums because as an autistic person, I couldn't relate and I couldn't connect with my peers. I was going online because I couldn't go out and party and drink and get laid with my classmates,
mm-hmm.
you know. Whereas now it's almost as if young men now, instead of going out and partying and drinking and getting laid with their, you know, like, you know, high schoolers used to do, they're almost preferring being online.
Right, right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, do you think there are elements of dealing with autism that make a person particularly receptive to the kinds of arguments that somebody like an Andrew Tate or, you know, one of these radical internet...
Elon Musk? Fine, let's talk about Elon Musk.
Sure, there you go.
let's talk about Elon Musk. I don't like talking about Elon Musk, but we got to talk about him, particularly because he is an autistic man, right?
He
has Asperger's syndrome, but even though Asperger's syndrome is no longer a thing, like, I don't think there's anything inherently biological
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that when you, as I said, because there's difficulty connecting with people, there's a difficulty with social isolation. I think that primes someone for being radicalized online.
Yeah.
And then I think also there's the tendency with, I don't think that it's necessarily something about the autism brain, but I think that like a lot of us have special interests. And when we get involved in something, we get involved into it like very, very intensely.
Right.
Like whether it's, you know, the common stereotype is trains or dinosaurs, but that's another form of masculinity too. You know, like
Sure.
How many of our dads indulge in their masculinity by watching World War II documentaries? Falling into an interest really heavily can predispose someone to, well, you're going to want to take everything to the farthest extreme.
I hear what you're saying about this idea of going deep on certain subjects, like really indulging in fixations on certain things. But, you know, we've also been talking about the gender roles component of this. And
there are these
studies that suggest that there are links between mental disorders and incels, the so-called involuntarily celibate men.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it is that we do see that a lot of autistic men or a lot of these quote unquote incels also self-identify as having mental disorders or having depression or having anxiety. It's so easy to internalize all that and just think that you're just not worth anybody's time.
Right.
So like if you're constantly told that you're not fully a man if you're autistic, or if you're told that like if you're autistic and you have difficulty dating or getting a job or all these other kind of totems, or if you have depression and that makes you, or you have a mental illness that makes it harder for you to hold a job, then it's very, very easy for you to see yourself as a failure as a man. It's very, very easy to fall into these kind of extremist ideologies. Yeah, at least that's how I see it.
Well, Eric Garcia is the senior Washington correspondent at The Independent, the author of the book We're Not Broken. Eric, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Tucson's bus and bus stop system has come under criticism recently. There have been some instances of violence at bus stops, including one in which a victim was killed at a streetcar stop. There are also reports of drug use at some bus stops. This comes as the city debates whether to continue its practice of not charging a fare to ride the bus. It's possible that program could end in the not-too-distant future. Tim Steller has written about all this. He's Metro columnist for the Arizona Daily Star and joins me as part of our ongoing series on shade called Throwing Shade. And Tim, how big of a topic of conversation is the bus system in Tucson?
It's a big topic of conversation. Part of it's because a lot of people don't believe in the idea of fare-free transit. And then separately, there's this issue that I wrote about on Sunday, which is the presence of congregations of drug users, especially at bus stops, certain bus stops in town, certain times. It's become a more and more visible phenomenon around town.
Are there people who equate the free fare situation with all those folks congregating around bus stops?
For sure. The debate, there's plenty of people who make that equation. The question is whether it's fair. I think it is in a couple of ways. One is that, of course, the people using drugs at the bus stops often do use the bus. They may use it to get where they are, where they're using, or they may use it after they're done. There is a link. But more importantly, there's kind of a political link, which is that those who oppose fare-free transit see these people crowded around the bus stop and say, you know, you see, this is what happens when you don't force people to pay a fare to ride the bus.
Which is kind of an interesting conundrum, right? Because the whole point for the city of not charging a fare was to get more people to ride the bus, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a tough call because it's not like everybody in Tucson was riding the bus before fare-free transit.
Yeah,
ridership peaked back in 2015. I think it was 2015, and then there was a driver's strike, and it's been lower than that ever since. So, I mean, it's a car town, just like Phoenix is, you know. So it's a relatively slim part of the population that rides the bus at all. I find it very useful not to have to pay a fare because I'm not an everyday bus user. I do it occasionally. And it's just great to be able to hop on, hop off without thinking about it. On the other hand, it's true that there are more street people who use the bus. And some of them have bothersome habits. You know, it's a tough call because these people, part of the idea is that poor people can then use the bus without having to pay for it and without even having to try to get a bus pass. So it's, on the one hand, it's a good thing that poor people are using it. On the other hand, some of the behavior that you see can be discouraging to the general public from riding the bus.
What did you hear from fellow bus riders as you were reporting and writing this piece about some of these issues?
You know, I've done this quite a few times now, writing about the fare free transit issue and buses in general. And that is, I get on, I go to bus stops, I talk to people. And the truth is that most people, most of the time, have totally normal and fine experiences riding the bus. The issue that has cropped up is that, like, one woman I talked to for quite some time was so upset, even though she's a poorer person, she said she'd happily pay fares if it would keep the fentanyl smokers away from the bus stops where she sometimes has to catch the bus. She said she, you know, basically stands away from the bus stop. And then when the bus arrives, she kind of hurries toward it and covers her mouth past the fentanyl smokers. And that's not something anyone should have to deal with. Now, they are doing things about it, but you know, you can't patrol every stop all day long.
Is that what the doing something about it tends to entail, having patrols near the stops?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they have private security who looks at the stops. And I was surprised to see private security guards ejecting people from bus stops. And in fact, when I talked to some people, they said, indeed, we get kicked out all the time. It's just that, you know, it's a monumental task to monitor all the bus stops all the time. And people have a right to sit at the bus stop and wait for the bus. So there's always that, you know, question as well. Are they actually waiting for the bus or are they just doing drugs or hanging out?
Is there reason to believe that if the city reinstituted fares for the bus, that there would be less drug use at bus stops?
That's a great question. And we don't know for sure. I mean, certainly there are people who can't afford anything because they are too hooked on drugs. And so, I don't know, it's possible that they wouldn't be able to ride the bus. Is that what we want? I don't know. That's a question. So I think it's an indirect relationship between the congregations at bus stops and fare-free transit, but it could have an impact if they reinstituted fares.
I know that in Phoenix, the sort of the structure of bus stops has often been a topic of discussion in terms of, are they benches? Are they single seats, like with armrests in between, that can discourage people from laying on them? Is there enough shade? Is there not enough shade? Is that something that is an issue in Tucson as well?
Oh, yeah, it's the same situation. And, you know, I think if the truth be told, the primary attraction of the bus stops is shade. Especially in the summer, you know, it's just people congregate where there's shade. It helps that you can also get to and from there by just stepping on or off the bus as well. But yeah, there's every variety I'm sure that you can see in Phoenix exists in Tucson. That is stops without any bench or anything, and then stops with benches and shades. And it's the stops with shades that, of course, attract people.
Yeah, I would imagine that even, you know, regardless of the fare situation, regardless of, for example, like drug use or anything, you know, other illicit activity, the fact that there is shade at these bus stops, I would imagine, even if you're not riding the bus, would be an attractive selling point, for example, to maybe people who are experiencing homelessness.
Absolutely. And then it's a bigger social phenomenon because, you know, for example, Santa Rita Park, the park that had the largest population of unhoused people, is closed now and being renovated. So the places where people normally hang out and get some shade are not as available as they once were. And frankly, there's a lot of increasing social tension, I would say, here about where such people can and should be. You know, there's I would say, increasing anger on the part of residents that there are, you know, unhoused people occupying certain parks or certain places. And this, so the bus stops are just probably a microcosm of that greater debate.
Is this something that it looks like the city council is going to have to be dealing with at some point in the not too distant future?
Oh, yeah, very soon. So about 6 weeks ago, the city council chose to pursue a study that they have to do in order to reinstitute fairs. That doesn't mean they're going to, but it's a precursor, it's a requirement to actually reinstituting fares. Now, the council has been unanimous in supporting fare-free transit for a couple of years. It's been 2 years that Tucson itself has been paying for the fare-free transit as opposed to the federal government. So in a couple of weeks or the next month or so, we're expecting the council to get the study and to maybe decide right then or begin deciding whether to try to reinstitute fares.
All right. That is Tim Steller, Metro columnist for the Arizona Daily Star. Tim, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.